Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We're currently working our way through the book of Revelation in our study of eschatology. Visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
To start tonight, we're going to go back and review a little bit of Daniel that we actually learned 3 years ago, whatever it was, when we were doing Daniel on Thursday nights. Because I think if we look at it tonight now, with all of the background we've got, it's going to, again, make more sense. I just keep plugging puzzle pieces in. It's going to give us the background we need to launch into Revelation 17:12, which is the 10 horns. And I told you 2 weeks ago we'd get into the 10 horns. But Daniel gives us the best definition of those 10 horns. So we're going to look at Daniel 7 tonight, look at Daniel's definition of those 10 horns, and then I think it'll be much more obvious when we get to the 10 horns in Revelation 17. It'll all line up much easier. So let's start with a word of prayer, and then we'll jump in. Heavenly Father, we gather before your word this evening, praying and trusting that you will open your word to us, trusting that you will use your word to edify our minds and our hearts. And we pray that we would see Jesus and that we would see him only and that we would have a greater understanding, a greater revelation of who he is and all of his power and magnificence, and that we will grow in our faith and in our confidence in our risen Lord. We pray these things in his precious name and for his sake. Amen. Daniel 7. Chapter 7, verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Verse 2, Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. The first was like a lion, and he had eagle's wings, and I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second like a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings as a bird, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Okay, so now we're introduced to the concept of the 10 horns. We know, and it's going to be defined for us coming up, what these beasts represent. Let's see how well you remember. What does the lion represent?
Babylon.
Babylon is the lion. So then what is the bear raised up on one side?
Medo-Persia.
Why is the bear raised up on one side?
Because one was stronger than the other.
Yes, which one?
Persia.
She's guessing. She's staring at the floor with that wide-eyed deer-in-the-headlight look. Persia? She had a 50-50 shot. So then behind that comes a leopard with wings. Who is that?
Alexander.
It's Alexander the Great in the Grecian Empire. And then you get into a fourth beast, great, dreadful, that has 10 horns. And it's going to be impossible, before we get to the end of chapter 7, it's going to be impossible not to conclude that that is a beast that is yet to come, a kingdom that is yet to happen, and these 10 kings have yet to appear on planet Earth. So then, in everything we know about the 7 kingdoms that have ever subjugated Israel, God's people, what's missing in this list of kingdoms?
Egypt, Assyria, and Rome.
Right. Egypt and Assyria are missing because they both predated Daniel having the vision. When Daniel had the vision, Babylon still stood, so it made sense that it would be successive kingdoms from there forward. But then it leaps from Greece to the end time kingdom again, and Rome is gone again. Very much like what we just read 2 weeks ago from Revelation when John hears about the beast that was, that is not, that will rise. This language is always consistent, that there doesn't seem to be one unified king like an Alexander or like a Cyrus or like a Nebuchadnezzar. There doesn't seem to be a particular king over Rome who can be centralized and identified as one of the beast heads individually. So Rome is missing. And again, this is consistent. When you see it in Daniel, he skips right from Greece to the end time kingdom. And when you see it in the book of Revelation, he talks about a beast that was, is not during John's time, during the time of the Roman Empire, and will rise out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. So this is very consistent that during the time that Jesus is on the planet, during the time of the apostles, and until the end of the Roman Empire splits into two, Eastern and Western Empire, the Byzantine Empire, two different capitals, all of that seems to not ever have a head, a figurehead, a leader, a horn that could be demonically possessed. When the angel was coming to tell Daniel about the forthcoming 490 years that had been determined on Israel, on Daniel's people, he's actually held up for 21 days. And do you remember what he said held him up?
The Prince of Persia.
The Prince of Persia, yeah. Here, let's look at it real quick, because this is very helpful. Flip over to Daniel 10 for a second. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, verse 1, the thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar, and the thing was true, and the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing, and he had an understanding of the vision in those days. I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks, 21 days. I ate no pleasant bread, neither came flesh nor wine in my mouth, neither did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. By the way, this is all happening during the time of Cyrus, king of Persia. So this is after Babylon has already fallen. Now the king of Persia has taken over. Daniel is still there, anticipating that the 70 years of the captivity predicted in Jeremiah was about to come to its close. And so he's praying that God is going to do the very thing God promised he would do, which is deliver the Israelites after 70 years, because the 70 years is coming to the full. In the 24th day of the first month, I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel. And I lifted up my eyes, and I looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body was like a beryl, and his face was the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color of polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude, and I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. For the men that were with me did not see the vision, but a great quaking fell upon them, so that they fled and they hid themselves. Therefore I was left alone, and I saw the great vision, and there remained no strength in me, for my comeliness was turned into corruption, and I retained no strength. Yet heard I the voice of his words, and when I heard the voice of his words, then was I in a deep sleep upon my face, and my face toward the ground. And behold, a hand touched me, and set me on my knees and upon the palms of my hands. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright, for unto thee am I now sent. And when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. And he said unto me, Fear not, Daniel. For from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before God, your words were heard, and I am come for your words. So that tells you that 21 days ago, the angel said, I was dispatched. Your words were heard, and I started coming toward you. I was bringing you a message from God. But it took me 21 days to get here. And he says it specifically. For from the first day that you did set your heart to understand and to chasten yourself before thy God, your words were heard, and I am come for your words. But, look at verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me. Now that's very interesting language because, like I said, in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, this all took place. So in what way can you say that the king of Persia withstood an angel? This is the angel Gabriel coming to speak to Daniel. In what way could the prince of Persia have withstood him in his journey from heaven to Daniel? Clearly, we're talking about a spiritual battle here, and we're talking about the spirit that possessed the prince of Persia, right? It's the only way you can read it. So here you have another example
of one of these leaders of one of these kingdoms that is demonically possessed, possessed on a spiritual level beyond simply being a mere mortal, a mere man. But then look at what it says. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me for 21 days. There it is again. But lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now, I am come to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. And when he had spoken such great words unto me, I set my face toward the ground, and I became dumb. And behold, one like the similitude of the sons of men touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth, and I spoke, and said unto him that stood by me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. For how can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord? For as for me, straightway there remained no strength in me, neither is there any breath left in me. And then there came upon me and touched me one with the appearance like a man, and he strengthened me, and he said, O man greatly beloved, fear not, peace be with you, be strong, yea, be strong. And when he had spoken unto me, I was strengthened, and I said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And he said, Do you know wherefore I have come to you? And now will I return to fight with the prince of Persia? And apparently they're going to win, because when I am gone forth, lo, the prince of Grecia shall come. So, well, there's two implications here. One is that part of the reason the prince of Grecia, who is Alexander the Great, part of the reason that he could conquer so overwhelmingly, even being pictured as a leopard, the fastest Middle Eastern animal they could think of, and then a leopard with wings. I mean, my goodness, that's an animal that could just sweep through a territory. Part of the reason he could sweep through that territory was, number one, he was demonically driven, demonically inspired, as it says here, lo, the prince of Grecia is coming. Secondly, the reason he could conquer Babylon and the prince of Persia was that the prince of Persia's spiritual power had been broken by the fact that Michael and Gabriel went and conquered the spiritual being that was behind the physical being who was the king of Persia. So since that spiritual hold was broken, then the physical hold could be broken. And the point here is it's like somebody pulled back the curtain for a minute and said, now let me tell you what's really happening. I know it looks like these are just wars and armies and people on the planet having their wars and different kings coming and going, but the angel says these are all spiritual battles that are going on, and they're being fought in the heavenlies, and what you see on the earth is just the overflow of what's happening in the heavenlies. So the point of that, especially in Daniel 10, is showing us this notion of the prince of Grecia and the prince of Persia being demonically driven, being demonically inspired, and being conquered by and doing war with angels in heaven. Got all that? Because coming up in Revelation 17, and we saw it 2 weeks ago, it said that the beast was of the seven. Even he was the eighth, but he was of the seven. And I said that's because he's going to possess, demonically possess, that seventh horn, the little horn, the Antichrist, whatever you want to call him, is going to be demonically possessed. And that's why it can then say that he does war with the saints, with Christ, and with the angels of heaven. In what way can he do that? Well, you already have a precedent for that set back here in Daniel 10. Got all that? Okay, that was all footnote to what we were reading in Daniel 7. So now go back to Daniel 7. So then back at Daniel 7, I saw a leopard, this is verse 6, which had upon his back four wings like a bird, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in my night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, and it devoured and it broke in pieces, and it stamped the residue of the feet thereof. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And beheld, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. So this little horn is Daniel's representation of the final world leader, the final leader that is going to be a demonically possessed leader. And it says that there are going to be 10 smaller horns, and he's going to pluck up 3 by the roots, which gives us the impression that what he's going to do is fight against three or conquer three. The other seven are going to end up giving him the authority, giving him the power, and he's going to rule over this 10-nation loose confederacy. And we know that it's a man because he had eyes like a man and a mouth speaking great things. That is sort of the bookend to the fact that the lion had eagle's wings and the wings were plucked off it and it stood up on its feet like a man and a man's heart was given to it, so that we understand in Daniel's vision that these are all men. These are kings. These are human beings. And so you've got Nebuchadnezzar over Babylon, a human being who was also the lion, who was the head of the Babylonian Empire, and he stood up and he was a man. And then you've got the prince of Persia, who we know from Daniel 10 was a man who was demonically possessed because he also fought with the angels. And then you've got, lo, the prince of Grecia comes, and we know that he's a demonically inspired Alexander the Great. And then you get to Rome, and there just simply isn't one of those guys, which is why in Revelation you see the beast that was, is not, and will rise up out of the abyss and go into perdition. But during the time that John was writing, there simply wasn't a demonic king on the earth like that. Even though there wasn't an empire, there was a kingdom, there was the Roman Empire, and there was a series of emperors, but none of them seemed to have risen to the status of an Alexander the Great, or of a Cyrus, or of the little horn that's yet to come. So I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Verse 9, and I beheld till the thrones were set down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was as pure wool. His throne was like a fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000s times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, the books were open. So in Daniel's vision, you go from Nebuchadnezzar to Medo-Persia to Grecia, right to the 10-nation confederacy, whenever that is, and right from there to the judgment. And so he seems to just jump right over Rome. Now, if that 10-nation confederacy, if these 10 nations can be found somewhere in history, and I actually brought an article tonight that we can read a piece of from Catholic Answers where they're going to explain to us that those 10 nations are already past. That's already history that already took place. Because you asked me, I think, 2 weeks ago, well, how do the Catholics deal with the 10 nations or the 10 kings or the 10 horns? And so I'm going to read from Catholic Answers tonight, too. They're going to try to push, as many people do, they try to push these 10 horns, these 10-nation loose confederacy, they try to push it back into the past somewhere. The common interpretation of Daniel's version of the 10 horns is that they are some generic set of kings, princes, or generals during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. You can find that lots of places. But then after Antiochus Epiphanes, which is before Christ by 100 years, then Christ comes on the planet and says the time of the tribulation is still future to him. And then you've got John on the Isle of Patmos. Whether you're going to early date it and say he was on Patmos somewhere in the 60s and wrote it then so that you can get your 70 AD scenario in there, or whether you say more rightly that he was on the Isle of Patmos from 92, 96 AD, for him to talk about the 10 horns, the 10 kings, the 10, that still pushes it future to Christ and his apostles. So it really takes Antiochus totally out of the equation. I beheld, the judgment was set. Verse 11, I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke. I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, those previous beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Clearly a messianic vision. One who looks like the Son of Man who comes to the Ancient of Days. I mean, you don't get much more messianic than that. And there was given to him, that Son of Man, dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people and nations and languages should serve him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. By the way, because his dominion is spoken of as being the replacement dominion or the conquering dominion of all these other kings that lasted for a short space and then they were gone, but then by contrast, he's going to have an everlasting dominion. In order to make that parallel the way Daniel does, you have to be talking about having dominion over the same area that these kings all had dominion over, which puts it back on earth. I'm sorry, anybody reading Daniel prior to the introduction of amillennial thought many years after Christ came and left, anybody reading it would say that Daniel was expecting an earthly physical kingdom, which is why all the Jews were looking forward to Messiah coming to establish an earthly physical kingdom, because all the language in the Old Testament is about an earthly physical kingdom, including this again.
How does your verse 14 read in the King James? Can you read that again?
And there was given to him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed.
I was just noticing what was given him, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that come and language might serve him. I was saying, is it all people? Anyway, clearly here, we already know that's not everybody.
It's not everybody, but it's clearly not just Israel.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the whole point of it being a worldwide dominion. He's not just coming as the Messiah of Israel that they've been looking for ever since Israel himself leaned on his staff and said that the lawgiver would come from Judah, that the scepter will not depart from Judah till Shiloh comes, whose right it is to rule, and the nations will gather to him. Ever since that promise, they've been looking for the Messiah to come through Judah, who is clearly Israel's Messiah. So when you get those kind of predictions, it's a prediction of a Messiah who would...
All means all.
Yeah, right.
Because we use that for John 3:16.
Yep.
Every tribe, nation.
Yep, exactly right. Again, consistent in its Judaistic approach. Verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions in my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of this. So he told me, and he made me know the interpretation of these things. Oh, good! That's helpful. I like it when they interpret. 17, the great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So where do those kingdoms exist?
On
the earth. He says right there, on the earth. So I still have to expect the kingdom to be on earth. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. It is very, very, very standard, reformed, amillennial thinking to say that that beast with the teeth of iron that stamped the residue thereof is Rome. And they say that that perfectly represents the way that the Roman armies marched, all in line, where before them it was all green valley and behind them nothing but stubble, because they would just mow down people as they came through, and they would say, clearly that's Rome. I'm going to show you now that it can't be Rome. But if you conclude that it is and that it must be Rome, then when you get to verse 20 and it says, and the 10 horns that were in the head, well, then those 10 horns must have something to do with Rome, right? And so they will say that those 10 horns are the first 10 Caesars, up usually to Nero Caesar, who they'll say, you know, was sort of the maximum bad guy. The problem with it is that he's going to make the leap in just a moment from the 10 horns to their destruction by Christ himself when he returns. And then, of course, with that kind of thinking, then you get into the preterist thinking that says, well, he did come back. He came back in 70 AD during the time of the Romans, right after Nero. He came back in 70 AD and he mowed down Jerusalem, and that's pretty much the end of everything, and prophecy is fulfilled, and there you go, preterism. So there are people who are willing to even continue through all of the implications of the notion that this is Rome who has the exceedingly dreadful teeth of iron. But look at verse 20. And of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Now, that's all one thought in Daniel's mind. You've got the 10 horns, you've got the little horn, and during the time of the little horn, the Ancient of Days came and the judgment was given to the saints. So unless you can say in some very real fashion that Christ returned, the judgment has actually happened. The judgment where the books are opened and the thousands upon thousands stand before God and they're judged out of what you find in the books. The same judgment you're going to see again at the end of the book of Revelation. And so unless you can say that all of that actually took place and that in some real sense, the Ancient of Days set up his kingdom, which means we are now living in the kingdom of God here on earth, which is a pretty lousy kingdom. I mean, it's just not the most impressive kingdom I've ever seen, if this is it. Especially if we're the saints who are supposedly reaping all the benefits of the kingdom, then I feel a little cheated. Feel a tad ripped off. But it's very, very clear that I beheld, and that same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came, and the judgment was given to the saints in the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. All of that is one thought in Daniel's economy, and it all has to do with the wrap-up of the little horn's reign. So again, I can't find a historic figure that satisfies those events. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of his kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and he will think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and a half a time. How long is that?
3.5.
How convenient is that? So that's the second half of Daniel's 70th week, the time of the tribulation. In the book of Revelation, that's called 1,260 days. It's also called 42 months. Daniel calls it a time, times, and half a time. But, verse 26, but the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion. Do you see that again, the language? He has to be ruling on earth when Christ returns. And unless you can say that Christ returned in some real way during the time of Nero, then Nero isn't it, regardless of what Hank would have you believe. And really no historic person can be said to be it because Christ simply hasn't returned. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. That's us. Do you feel like you've received that yet? Have you signed up yet for your kingdom, your dominion, and the greatness of the kingdom? That's yours by right here. Has that happened yet? In its narrowest definition, saints here means Israelites, the descendants of the very people who have the promise of the kingdom ever since Abraham. Can you say that the Israelites at this point are actually basking in the glory of their kingdom and dominion and greatness of their kingdom? Well, no, of course not. Well, then none of this has happened yet. Or God was lying. Or God was being purposefully obtuse so that nobody would understand what he was talking about.
I don't even own
my house outright yet. Yeah, you don't even own your house outright yet. And supposedly you've got the glory of the kingdom. Yeah.
The bank still
owns it. Yeah, exactly. It shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Is there any way you can say that all kingdoms and dominions on earth right now serve and obey Christ?
No.
No. Well, then that can't have happened yet.
Has there ever been a single kingdom that obeyed Christ?
But the point is, that's the outcome of the time when the little horn is on the planet. And so, if you're going to identify the little horn as some historic person, you have to be able to explain in what way are all the kingdoms of earth and dominions on earth, all the kings on earth right now, are now subject to the Most High God. It doesn't exist. And it didn't exist in 70 AD. And it doesn't exist today. So, again, either God lied or it just hasn't happened yet. And that, again, is why I am a futurist. I can't read this stuff any other way if I'm willing to read it at face value for what it actually says and plug in all the pieces that fit back and forth between Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation. They create a very, very consistent, and I think you've seen the consistency of it now, it creates a very consistent pattern. And when you plug in all the puzzle pieces, they all fit together really, really well, unless you just have some kind of prejudice against millennialism or futurism, or unless you're just so steeped in amillennialism, or you're just so confident in your post-mill approach, or any of that. Unless you're being led by a system so that you're forced to read this through the filter of your system, if you'll just let it say what it says, it's just very, very consistent. It all fits together very nicely. You don't have to do any twisting. You don't have to do a great deal of interpreting. You let the angel's interpretation stand. There's a unique idea. And you let the words that are in the book just say what they say. It all meshes right together. So I simply don't understand the attraction or ultimately the spiritual value of preferring a system over what it plainly says, even if what it plainly says leads you into sounding like a dispensationalist. Oh, no. But I'm very comfortable saying I'm a futurist. This has to be future. Or you have to be able to show me somebody who satisfies everything that we've read here. Any ideas? Anybody want to offer anybody up? Because there's people out there like Hank saying, Nero. I don't know, Hank. I can't hang with the Nero idea. I can't hang with Antiochus Epiphanes. Jesus canceled that idea out. I can't go with Titus in 70 AD because Jesus didn't come back. So, you know, who is it? Hitherto is the end of the matter. There, see, I like that language. Verse 28 starts with Daniel saying, now look, that's the end of the matter, okay? I've said it plainly. That's how it's going to go. That's the end of the matter, okay? Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Turn to Revelation 17. Starting at like verse 7, here we've got an angel explaining to John, the very same way that you had an angel explaining to Daniel, here you have an angel explaining to John. And they're both describing the same stuff. The angel said to me, wherefore did you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carried her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was, is not, shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. They that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. That is, by the way, that leap that is consistent in Revelation and Daniel. That leap goes from Alexander, lo, the king of Grecia comes, to the final beast and the possession of the final beast, which is why I think, if I have to pick a demonic power that I think is going to possess the little horn, I think it's going to be that same Alexander power. Whatever that power was that drove Alexander. Alexander died outside the walls of Babylon. I believe that that is the power that was put into the bottomless pit, is going to come out of the pit and go into perdition again. Now, that's just speculative on my part. I'm just connecting dots to say, well, if you watch the prince of Persia, and then he's conquered, and then the prince of Grecia comes, and then during the time of John, the beast was, is not, will be again, then some beast that previously existed as a world ruler is going to rise again and be world ruler again. And I think the leading contender for that is that Alexander power, because of in Daniel when he has the goat with the notable horn and the notable horn is cut off and Alexander's kingdom immediately is divided up among his four generals. That power that drove Alexander the Great was cut off in its prime. And that to me seems perfect, the notion that they would like squash it and hold it in the bottomless pit until the right time to let it out and go into perdition again. Whatever one it was, it is one that was before. You know what I mean? Whichever one it is that's coming back, it is one that was previously. So this is a power that has been a world ruler previous to the time of the Roman Empire. But during the time of the Roman Empire, it's in the bottomless pit. And after the time of the Roman Empire, it's going to be released from the pit and go into perdition. Those are big, heady, heavy concepts, but I can't read it any other way. The beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen. One is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and he is of the seven, and he goes into perdition. That's the verse that talks about the demonic possession of this seventh ruler, the seventh king, is going to be possessed by the beast. All of that was introduction to verse 12. It's 5 minutes to eight, and I finally got to the verse I was trying to get to. All of that was introduction to get us to verse 12. And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now, that takes Antiochus Epiphanes completely out of the game plan, right? Because the angel just said, whether John was writing in 60 AD or 90 AD, he said these are 10 kings that haven't received a kingdom yet. So they're clearly future to John. And if John was on Patmos 92 to 96 AD, as I am convinced he was, as history tells us he was, then after Nero and the worst of the Roman emperors are gone, during the time of the split of the Eastern and Western Empire, these kings still haven't risen. They're still waiting to come around. So, Catholic Answers says, concerning the ten horns, the angel also interprets for John the meaning of the beast's ten horns, saying, and the ten horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they give over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. That's verse 13 and 14 as well. By the way, it says that during the time of those 10, Christ comes back, right? So again, unless you can find Christ coming back, you haven't seen the 10 kings yet. These are of one mind. They give their power and authority to the beast. They'll make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. So there they are. This shows us, here's their interpretation, this shows us that the beast is allied with 10 lower rulers and with their own territories. Some fundamentalists, bent on making this apply to modern times and to the Catholic Church, have argued that the horns refer to the European community and a revival of the Roman Empire with the Catholic Church as its head. That's, of course, what you see in all of the Left Behind stuff. They're very big on the EU, the European Union, and they're very big on saying that the European Union is ultimately going to be 10 nations. There's also another one that I saw on the internet the other day, and I was surprised how often this theory popped up, that the United Nations has a grid that they use for the whole Earth, where they divide the Earth into 10 segments. And so that somehow the Antichrist is going to take over the United Nations, and apparently from that seat of power will take over the 10 leaders of those 10 grids of the world. I don't know. I read that one and went, that's new. The problem with, of course, the European Union idea is that they're beyond 10 now. What are they, 14, 15 nations in the European Union now? So there's a problem there. Apparently, once the Antichrist takes over the European Union, he'll have to, like, kick out five or six of them, and then he'll have his 10. But as we've seen, the Antichrist is not going to come out of Europe. He's not going to be a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Carpathian character. He's going to be a Middle Eastern character who's going to come up out of the old Seleucid portion of the Alexandrian Empire. So the ten nations don't have to be European nations. They could very easily be the same old ancient enemies that have been around ever since the fight between Ishmael and Isaac. That's where it all began. Ishmael and Isaac have been fighting ever since.
So the, PBS had a special on last night called Israel and the Arabs, Elusive Peace, and just tracking over just the past, about the past 5-6 years of just, peace talks, and then somebody blowing somebody up, and then they're going bombing, and then they get, and no side will back down, of course, and it's just us. It's Ishmael versus Isaac.
That's all it is. And it's been around that long. And so since that is like a central theme, a central thread of the whole Bible, of course it makes complete sense that those ten nations would be Ishmaelites that are surrounding Israel, that are ancient enemies of Israel, that would naturally want to do war with the saints, the Israelites. I mean, it's just, that is so consistent biblically that I'm much more prone to go there than decide that it's a blonde-haired European that is going to be the Antichrist. But yeah, watching that stuff that's going on right now, Jeff, was it 3 weeks ago when they gave up the occupied territory? And everybody was going, oh, that'll do it. Did that do it? What was it, 2 days before they were bombing again? You're not going to be able to settle this stuff with peace pacts or signing stuff on the White House lawn or giving up little pieces of land. That's not going to do it. The hatred goes all the way back, according to Paul writing to the Galatians. It has to do with the children of the free and the children of the bondwoman, and that the children of the bond will always hate the children of the free. I mean, that's deep-rooted spiritual stuff on par with the king of Persia and the king of Grecia. I mean, this is deep-rooted spiritual stuff, where the Ishmaelites even have their own religion that harkens back to Abraham, but hates the Jews and Christians. All of that just lines up so unbelievably biblically. But anyway, back to Catholic Answers. So we know that it's not the EU. And they say, of course, the problem is that there are 10 kings, but there are now many more than 10 nations in the European community. And they're absolutely right, but they think that they have therefore exploded the standard Protestant interpretation of the 10 kings, and they have, if your interpretation is the left behind interpretation, which I disagree with. They haven't done any damage to what the Bible says of it being out of the Seleucid portion of the Alexandrian Empire. However, what we are told about the horns does fit one of the other candidates we have for the whore, apostate Jerusalem. The angel tells John, "And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the harlot, and they will make her desolate and naked, and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and giving over their royal power to the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled." That's chapter 17, verse 16 and 17. If the whore is Jerusalem and the beast is Rome, I don't know how you separate the two, but there you go, with the 10 horns as vassal states. See what he just did? The 10 horns are now vassal states of ancient pagan Rome. Which vassal states? Which 10? Where are they geographically? Who are they? They don't tell you. But by doing that, they're able to push the whole thing back into the past. And by making it vassal states and not individual kings, then you don't have to deal with that whole, oh yeah, Christ comes back during their time and they make war with Christ, with the Lamb, and he conquers them. And if the whore is Jerusalem and the beast is Rome, with the 10 horns as vassal states, then the prophecy makes perfect sense. Did that solve it for you? That clear everything up for you? It makes perfect sense. Come on. The alliance between the two in persecuting Christians broke down in AD 66 to AD 70 when Rome and its allied forces conquered Israel and then destroyed, sacked, and burned Jerusalem, just as Jesus prophesied in Luke 21, 5 to 24, end of article. Except that John wrote this in 92 to 96 AD and said these kings have not received power yet. So the idea that they were vassal states that were part of the sacking of, and I love this language, the alliance between the two, which is Jerusalem the whore Jerusalem being apostate Jerusalem, and the beast being Rome, pagan Rome, that their alliance between the two in persecuting Christians broke down in AD 66 to AD 70 when Rome and the allied forces conquered Israel. What Christians are we talking about there that happened to be in Jerusalem at the time? None of this is making historic sense. When Rome sacked Jerusalem, did they do that to conquer Christians?
No.
They were quelling the uprising of the Jews. They weren't going in there trying to shut Christianity down. But according to Catholic Answers, that solves everything. And of course, it all broke down in AD 66 to 70 when Rome and its allied forces conquered Israel and then destroyed, sacked, and burned Jerusalem. There you go. Now the whole prophecy fits together just perfectly, except for the fact that apparently John, 22, 26 years after this, felt it was necessary to sit down and write about it in the future tense. I guess so that the other people who read it wouldn't understand it. But so you asked me a couple weeks ago, how did the Catholics deal with the Ten Kings? That's how. It's the theological equivalent of the shell game. Okay, watch the P, watch the Ten Kings. Here we go, a little razzle-dazzle, razzle-dazzle. Hey, there they are over there. We're all done. There's no way that the Ten Kings are ten vassal states of pagan Rome pre-70 AD. How does that make any sense at all with what the text says?
I was about to say, are they saying that from the time, let's give them the 66, is that when they say John wrote this?
In that area somewhere, pre-AD 70.
All right, well, they didn't exist. These are ten kings that are not right now.
Yeah, during John's time, it says they didn't exist and that they were going to get a kingdom later.
Right.
So even if he had written it, you're exactly right, even if he had written that pre-AD 70, these were vassal states that rose up in the next 3 years somehow.
And nobody documented it.
Yeah, right. So
around 73 AD.
But this is what passes for theology.
And that's my other thing I have with preterism. There's nobody who wrote about Jesus coming back? I mean, that would have been a pretty significant thing.
You would also think that if preterism were true, you would have seen a great explosion of preteristic thought right around 80, 90 AD. They would have all said, hey, there it is. Wow, it's all wrapped up. Wow, that's just perfect, great. And instead, what you saw for the next 300 years was the rise of millennialism. So certainly nobody in the first 300 years of the Christian church seemed to say what the preterists are now saying. But again, it's so easy, it's so convenient 2,000 years after the fact, or 1,500, or 1,700, or however many years after the fact, it's just so easy to interpret and say, oh, this is what it means, because all the people who were alive during that time who could be eyewitness to it and tell you no, 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 have been dead for 2,000 years. So you really don't have any opposition. You can just make stuff up. So all right, let's just wrap this up. The ten, this is verse 12, Revelation 17, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. So whenever the beast is on the scene, that's when these ten kings get power. That means they can't be vassal states. They have to actually be kings. They have one mind, and they shall give their power and their strength to the beast. So that's where Daniel tells us he uproots three. Here you see that they all give him the authority. So he's going to have kingship over 10 nations. And if those are 10 Middle Eastern nations, then he has control of most of the world's oil supply. That's a nice platform from which to work. Verse 14, these shall make war with the Lamb. So these 10 kings and the beast make war with Christ. And the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. There we are. That's us. Hey, he comes back with the 10,000s of his saints, according to Jude, and that'd be us. He comes back with those that are called and chosen and faithful. And he said unto me, the waters that you saw where the whore sits are people and multitudes and nations and tongues, just like Daniel's language. Verse 16, and the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. Look at verse 17, for God has put into their hearts the evil kings who give the authority to the beast. God put into their hearts to fulfill his will. Isn't that remarkable? God put into the hearts of the evil, wicked kings to fulfill his will, and that's why they gave their authority to the beast. Why? So that everything would happen exactly the way God said it's going to happen. God put into their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdoms to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. So here again, you have a perfect example of God completely controlling the will and the outcome of evil, wicked people who are not trying to do his will. They're not trying to fulfill prophecy, and yet they're going to do exactly what God said they're going to do. They're going to give up their kingdom to the beast so that God can come back and wipe up the floor with the beast. And the woman which you saw is that great city that reigns over the kings of the earth. We'll pick up there next week and remind me, because we'll have to go back and look a little bit at verse 16 and the fact that the 10 horns that you saw upon the beast will hate the whore and make her desolate and naked, because there is a distinction then there between the political power of the beast and the religious power of the whore sitting on the seven hills. And if that's the case, then what you've got is a fight between Antichrist and his political power and the fact that the woman, Babylon religion, ultimately ends up getting her just due by the 10 kings who are being controlled by God to do God's will. God uses those 10 kings to go over and defeat Babylon, the whore. So remind me next week, and we'll talk about that, because it's clear that that's the first place where you're going to see a division between the Antichrist and that Babylonish religious system is going to be brought down by the 10 kings who God puts in their heart to hate the whore. So God's control, again, is absolutely sovereign and amazing.
Thank you for joining us for this week's study. We invite you back next week for another Salvation by Grace message.